this morning is from a review of a book that you will hear read from in the second reading. The reviewer is Ariane Brathwaite-Len. She's a minister in Indiana, I think Presbyterian. This story will certainly elicit, I think, lots of feelings and reactions from hearts in this room. I know I felt many deep feelings and reacted to this reading when I first read it.
When Dan and Lynn Wagner received the parole officer's letter, they had to make a critical decision. Lisa, the woman who had killed their two daughters in an accident while driving drunk and high, was about to be released from prison. In order to continue their own healing and bring closure, the Wagners decided to meet with Lisa. They fully expected to release the relationship and move on, but a completely unexpected thing happened. When we walked into the room and laid our eyes on Lisa for the first time, we both hugged her. Dan said, "I don't know why, but it suddenly seemed as if we had been through this war together." In that hug and in my heart, I felt a sense of relief. We walked into that building in fear, thinking we were finally going to have an end, but it turned out to be a beginning.
And the second reading comes from the very book from which that story was retold. It's the Book of Forgiving by the great Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his daughter, Mpho. Both of them are priests in the Anglican tradition. I do not think there is a greater, wiser teacher about forgiveness than Desmond Tutu alive today on earth.
There were so many nights when I, as a young boy, had to watch helplessly as my father verbally and physically abused my mother. I can still recall the smell of alcohol, see the fear in my mother's eyes, and feel the hopeless despair that comes when we see people we love hurting each other in incomprehensible ways. If I dwell in those memories, I can feel myself wanting to hurt my father back in the same ways he hurt my mother and in ways of which I was incapable as a small boy. I see my mother's face and I see this gentle human being who I loved so very much and who did nothing to deserve the pain inflicted upon her. When I recall this story, I realize how difficult the process of forgiving really is. Intellectually, I know my father caused pain because he was in pain, but it is still difficult. The traumas we have witnessed or experienced live on in our memories. Even years later, they can cause us fresh pain each time we recall them. Are you hurt and suffering? Is the injury new, or is it an old, unhealed wound? Know that what was done to you was wrong, unfair, and undeserved. You are right if you are outraged. And it is perfectly normal to want to hurt back when you have been hurt. But hurting back rarely satisfies. We think it will, but it doesn't. If I slap you after you slap me, it does not lessen the sting I feel on my own face, nor does it diminish my sadness as to the fact that you have struck me at all. Retaliation gives, at best, only momentary respite from the pain. The only way to experience healing and peace is to forgive. Until we can forgive, we remain locked in our pain and locked out of the possibility of experiencing healing and freedom, locked out of the possibility of being at peace. Without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound with chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and our own feelings. We become our own liberators. We don't forgive to help the other person. We don't forgive for others. We forgive for ourselves.
I don't know about you, but when the leaves start to slowly take on color in this month of October, memories of autumn's past pour into my mind. Burning piles of scented leaves when I was a child, before it was forbidden to do so. The big mountainous piles which we as children threw ourselves into with the kind of glee that never ever gets tired. The afternoon sun, lower in the sky, painting everything orange in the early evening. The spiced stillness of a cool autumn night. Lovely. When, however, in the same autumn season, I read the paper or hear the news these days. As often as not, I am confronted with disturbing information that clobbers me and siphons off all of the comforting, sensual images of the colorful fall. This group called ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, all of these acronyms are perfectly correct, is executing people in a ghastly way. Executing people as terrorists might in order to crumple the souls of the rest of the world, especially those of us in the United States of America and in Europe.
Yes, Muslim scholars and teachers in great numbers around the world are denouncing these terrorists as anti-Quran, just like the Christians of all stripes that I know of denounced Westboro Baptist Church as a real perversion of that tradition. But nevertheless, the horrors are real. They're cold-blooded. They're almost beyond belief. Now, no matter what the news is, and every single year in the fall, at least, of course, here in the Northern Hemisphere, the Jewish celebration of Yom Kippur comes hand in hand with the descending leaves. The sacred day offers a yearly opportunity to reflect on one particular powerful word, and that is forgiveness. Many of our congregations have joined our Jewish cousins in lifting up the themes from this holiday for over 100 years. Most of my colleagues, in fact, this morning are wrestling with this particular word today. I welcome this yearly rhythm of wrestling with forgiveness, for my own life has convinced me that forgiveness is an essential part of my life's work. It's not just one day in the autumn, one sermon, but it's every day. How do I forgive others when they hurt me without even knowing that they have? It happens all the time. How do I forgive myself for saying stupid or thoughtless things to people I really, sincerely love with all my heart? How do I forgive myself for neglecting my own health sometimes? How can others forgive my impulsivity? How do I forgive those in this state who pass laws against same-gender marriage, women's health access, and voter rights? How do I forgive family members and friends who drank or drugged themselves to death, or who led with explosive, violent tempers so as to hurt everyone in the room every single time? You see? Small list, but every day can be a good day for wrestling with forgiveness. Now, often, after I preach about forgiveness on the Sunday closest to Yom Kippur, I receive questions. They're fascinating questions. I love answering them. But always there's one question, which goes like this. Somebody names Adolf Hitler and says, but how can anyone forgive a monster like him? I confess that I used to be really irritated by that question because it always sounded like it was intended, deviously, to invalidate the whole idea of forgiveness at all. First, I used to say, I cannot forgive someone who is dead and never admitted being wrong in the first place. You're playing a game with the word forgiveness. Second, speaking a name, a person's historical name, that does indeed evoke great evil, is not an argument for anything. It does not automatically devalue the word forgiveness because he existed. But now, before you all, I apologize for my irritation. I don't think anymore that's why most honest people evoke the name of Adolf Hitler after a sermon on forgiveness. Because that name is more than a name. It's a symbol. It understandably symbolizes all the terrors of monstrous evil which have risen up from the human race through the centuries, including the decades in our own lives, no matter how old we are. The school shootings, the church shootings, the lynchings, buildings blown up in New York, Washington, and Oklahoma City, the Cambodian massacres of Pol Pot, the My Lai massacres in Vietnam the tortures in South Africa, the Tutsis and Hutus in their debacle in Rwanda, and now the catastrophic spreading of Ebola. I think the name Hitler dutifully symbolizes all of these horrible events, horrific events. How can anyone deal with such atrocities at all? What sense does the world make with such horrors being commonplace? How can I have buoyant hope when terror is as frequent as sunrise? These are fair questions. I understand that now. But yet, despite the horrors, and I didn't name half of them, Desmond Tutu and his daughter Mpho keep answering with the same answer: forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. And Archbishop Tutu knows terror firsthand. I think that was clear in the reading. Not only did his drunken father hurt his mother all throughout his childhood, but he experienced also firsthand the cruelties and bloodshed during South Africa's apartheid decades. The stories he personally heard while sitting on the Truth and Reconciliation Committee of South Africa are almost unbearable to read. As I read his accounts in the book in which he recorded them, I often found myself throwing the book against the wall. So disgusted and despairing was I to know human beings could act in that way, think in that way, do such things. But you know what? Tutu's committee got people who killed to talk with the relatives of those they murdered. They both told their stories in each other's presence. Tutu's committee was able to slowly but surely effect a change in an entire nation, with the help of others, of course, who claimed that the power of forgiveness is the only final power that can make sense of the world. Now, a little review here. Remember, forgiveness does not mean in any way, shape, or form, "Oh, that's all right. We know you didn't mean it." Of course they meant it. The systems they created meant it too. Forgiveness does not mean foregoing consequences, including prison terms. It does not mean foregoing justice in any way, any shape, any form. Forgiveness is not simply the false justice of revenge or honor killings or avoidance. It's none of that. But it is tied up with justice. When I read the story of the parents who lost their two daughters to a driver both drunk and high, I felt as if someone had hauled off and hit me in the face with a skillet. It hurt just to read the words when I first read them. These two parents met with the drunk who killed their daughters? What kind of power is that? Yet the story ends not only with the parents meeting the woman who killed their children, but forming a relationship with her. The mother and Lisa, who had spent time in prison, significant time, for the killings, now travel this country together, visiting prisons, visiting houses of worship and schools, to serve as living examples of, as Ariane Len puts it, of how forgiveness transforms one's pain. Note, does not end the pain, transforms it. There's a big difference. In Rwanda, 20 years ago this year, the Hutu majority almost wiped out the Tutsi and Twa minority. It was a genocide, it was not a war. Yet now, 20 years later, they too are in the midst of a Truth and Reconciliation process themselves, patterned on the one from South Africa. It seems impossible they could do this to me, doesn't it? In the New York Times, however, not long ago, there was an excellent photo essay about just this amazing event. People who had brutally killed whole families reconciling with the straggling survivors. Reconciling with them, meeting them, hearing their stories, asking for forgiveness, embracing the anguished ask for forgiveness. One Hutu man got 50 other fellow Hutus to build a house overnight, a barn raising, for the remnant of a family he had slaughtered. One Tutsi reflected, "Sometimes justice does not give a satisfactory answer. When I granted forgiveness, however, I felt my mind at rest." One Hutu perpetrator said, "I had lost my humanity because of the crime I committed, but now, after asking for and receiving forgiveness, I am a human being again." Person by person, Rwanda is being transformed. Can you believe it? It's like South Africa was. And, oh, of course, you're right. It doesn't happen with everyone. Nothing in this world is perfect, not even forgiveness. There is no system of perfect justice. Some are so bent for whatever reason that nothing in this lifetime will get them to even admit that they did anything wrong, let alone ask for forgiveness. But the whimsical children's story this morning affirms that despite forgiveness not being a clean sweep, it is the only way out of the ridiculous and endless reality of reactionary living. Be hit, get hit back. Be hit, get hit back. In the whole story, the whole population of the planet, isolated in terror, were isolated in terror because they thought justice only meant that. That one thing, forever and ever, amen. Tit for tat. Exactly. Balancing the pain for the pain. The reading from the Tutus that you heard earlier sounds almost as if they were interpreting the story, even though I'm sure Tutu and his daughter never read the story. They wrote, "If I slap you after you slap me, it does not lessen the sting I feel on my own face, nor does it diminish my sadness as to the fact that you struck me in the first place. Retaliation gives, at best, only momentary respite from our pain. The only way to experience healing and peace, shalom, as the choir sang, is to forgive. Until we can forgive, we remain locked in our pain and locked out of the possibility of experiencing healing and freedom, locked out of the possibility of peace." Oh, this is very hard to get, isn't it? It's very difficult. It requires far more struggle and thought and even pushback than can be found in a single Sunday celebration about forgiveness. So please, by all means, take all the time you need. I know I need all that time. I'm going to be working on this till my dying day, no question. But no matter what, I do have to end my sermon this morning, I think, with the Tutu's great final insight. For forgiveness is not finally about the other person. Whether the name is Hitler or not makes no difference. Forgiveness does not bless or excuse any injustice, but recognizes that without at least struggling to forgive, even if you never get there finally, we cannot fully be who we are. In the Tutu's exact words, Without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound with chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and our own feelings. We become our own liberators. We don't forgive to help the other person. We don't forgive for others. We forgive for ourselves. Unquote. And please remember, forgiveness does not mean having to spend time with someone who hurt you, especially as a child. You don't have to do any such thing. You don't have to meet with them in a room. They were not trustworthy then, and forgiveness does not have any magical qualities to make them trustworthy now. You have to do this sensibly. Forgiveness is not some perfect reconciliation, but it's a way to live a freer life. So yes, the autumn is here. The leaves are turning yellow and red, and they're descending, as the poet says. And we too, like the trees, have a great deal to release. Release everything that doesn't keep us alive. The red leaves are no longer helping the tree stay alive. So the tree releases them. And to quote Jane Hirschfield at the top of your page, although we are flawed and the world is marred, forgiveness seems to be a kind of loneliness. Forgiveness is a kind of loveliness that sets us free. It may not be perfect, as Jane Hirschfield says, but it is enough.